Okay. I got here and found out I didn't have my power cord, and so that's probably going to go dark sometime during class. Just know that the slides you don't see are far more impressive than you ever could have imagined. So we'll be picking up in Hebrews 12. We're sort of in the final stages of the Hebrew writer's letter slash sermon. He has made a case for Christ being vastly superior in every kind of way, greater messenger than the angels, therefore a greater message, greater than Moses, and leading the people to a greater rest, a better high priest with better sacrifices, and a better covenant. And so in every sense, he has shown them that going back to the old law would be a terrible, terrible mistake that would alienate them from God. However, going back to the faith of their fathers in the sense of trusting in that which cannot be seen and suffering for the hope that they have is very much in full accord with what he is asking them to do. And so he's built this case going back all the way back to Abel and coming forward throughout history, probably including the prophets and even some people in more recent history who have died for the faith. He has made a case that they need to trust in the promises of God and continue to seek that which is as yet unseen, but promised by God, with the knowledge that God is faithful and he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And so he picks up in chapter 12, and he we talked about this a little bit last time. He says, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, speaking about these examples of faith, let us lay aside every encumbrance. And we began to talk about that in class last time, the idea of getting rid of anything that is going to impede their progress toward realizing their hope. And then he talks about, moving on, he talks about the sin which so easily entangles us. Now, obviously, any sin entangles us. And this statement can be taken broadly and generally, and we think about various kinds of sins. But what specific sin are they struggling with? What does he perhaps have in mind, or has he had in mind earlier in the book? We think about Hebrews 10:26. If we go on sinning willfully, what specifically is he thinking about? Okay, right. Going back to the old law, abandoning their faith, allowing the pressures of the world to push them away from continued faithful service to God. We could characterize this in many ways. Choosing comfort over holiness. Choosing the easy way over the difficult way. There are many ways we could characterize this. Choosing the favor of men versus the favor of God. But that's the kind of thing that he's talking about. Now, obviously, there is potentially a full scale apostasy in the offing here that he's trying to stop. But I think we also need to think about the idea that he who is faithful in little is faithful in much. And so there are 1,000 small ways in which we can choose comfort over holiness, or choose the approval of men over the approval of God. And there's a strong warning in the letter to the Hebrews against those sorts of choices. And so he tells us not, that's what he means by these things easily entangle us. It's not a difficult choice to make. He's not talking about going from, being a respectable citizen to, hanging out in a crack house and joining a motorcycle gang and, just that complete. These are sometimes small, incremental choices that can lead to a very bad place. And he's spoken in those terms from the very beginning, because back in chapter 2, he warned them and us against drifting. And he says, it's easy to drift away from the faith. Don't drift away from the faith. And so he is going to suggest a number of things, both in the way of how we think and some things that we need to do to help ourselves and one another keep from becoming entangled in these sorts of sins and keep from drifting away from the faith and making these very easy but very dangerous compromises, small compromises that can lead to bigger compromises. And so the first thing he tells us to do is he says, fix your eyes on Jesus. Okay, you need to, these other examples are great, but they are great solely because they anticipate a yet greater example. And that is the example of Jesus Christ, who is the author and perfecter of faith. And so he is setting Jesus up as the one who goes before. Does anybody have, in Hebrews 12:2, does anyone have a substantively different translation for author and perfecter? Source and perfecter, okay. Anything else? Finisher, okay, good. I think that that kind of gets the idea, the author, the finisher. We might think about it in terms of the pioneer of our faith. So he's gone before us and completed and perfected faith. And so he says, I want you to fix your eyes on Jesus, because he's already been down the road we're going down. And so consequently, we can follow him. And it's an interesting thing. When you follow somebody, you end up where they end up. That's sort of the nature of the whole thing, which is why he wants us to follow Jesus. And he's gonna take us down, the Hebrew writer's gonna kind of take us down that road. And so he first says that as the author and perfecter of our faith, he says, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. So what does it mean, the joy set before him? And how does that parallel the situations in Hebrews and our own situation? Right, exactly. And so, obviously, the joy set before him has nothing to do, and this is important, it has nothing to do with anything immediately before him. The joy set before him is on the other side of the things immediately before him, and thus parallel to our own situation. So, there's a principle, I know I've talked about this before, but my own experiences make this sort of stick out. If you overcook a turn on a motorcycle and you start looking at the turn instead of looking past it, you will go off the road. Don't ask me how I know that. But if you fix your eyes on what's right in front of you, especially out of fear, That will be where you go. And so they always say, don't look where you don't want to go. You look where you want to end up, not at the threat that's immediately in front of you, whether it be in the form of a fence or a tree or whatever. Thankfully, there were none of those things involved in this particular situation. But don't look where you don't want to go. You got to keep your eyes fixed on the joy set before you, which in that case, the joy was not crashing. But a lot of times when something threatening is right in front of us, that we can't take our eyes off of it. And the Hebrew writer is saying, you need to take your eyes off that and you need to get your eyes on Jesus. Because He made it through. He made it through that situation. Maybe y'all don't identify with that as well as I would have hoped, but maybe one day you will. Maybe share that experience, or Bob can tell you about it or something. We need to keep in mind the joy set before us, just as He did. And because He had His mind beyond what was beyond the cross, He was able to endure the cross. And He was able to endure the horrors of that. It says, when He endured the cross, He despised the shame. He despised the shame. And the word despised here means to count as not very significant. So, obviously, there was a lot of shame attached to the cross. But Jesus, if we think about this in a physical kind of way, He put the shame on one side of the balance, and He put the joy on the other side of the balance, and it went, and the joy was much weightier than the shame. The shame of the cross, the suffering of the cross, was lightweight in comparison to the joy of being with His Father, taking up His throne, realizing the purposes of God, all of those things that were going to be attached. Paul uses this exact kind of metaphor when he talks about a momentary light affliction versus an eternal weight of glory. And so Paul says the affliction is light. Now, Paul wasn't afflicted as much as Jesus was, but he was afflicted. Okay, a lot. But he says that's momentary and that's lightweight. Because it is momentary, it's lightweight. The glory is, according to Paul, eternal and therefore weighty. How much does that weigh? Well, it has an infinite weight. The affliction, that's only momentary. It's only momentary. And so Jesus despised the shame. And those who follow Jesus are going to despise the shame. The world may hate us. The world may afflict us. The world may treat us badly. But it's a momentary light affliction. And it's not nearly as weighty as the glory, the joy. And so where is, in the context of Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 2, where is Jesus now? Yeah, He's sitting down at the right hand of God. And that's pretty much where the Hebrew writer has Him. For most of this idea that he sat down. And that has a dual sense in the book of Hebrews. And now maybe even a third sense. Okay? It speaks to His being enthroned, so He's a king. And of course, that's really significant in the first chapter of Hebrews, all those passages pointing back to the Davidic covenant. It speaks to Him having completed His work as a high priest. They stand ministering daily, but having offered a sacrifice once for all, He sat down at the right hand of God. And so His priestly ministry is complete. And now the third sense of sat down is brought to bear in this passage where it suggests now that he has realized his hope as the author and perfecter or finisher of faith. His hope has been realized. He is sitting at the right hand of God. And so that's the goal. That's where we want to end up. And so we need to fix our eyes on that. And not worry about the intervening troubles, which are just, we're just kind of passing through. And so he calls on us again in verse 3. Consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself. And so he says, think about what Jesus went through. Think about the road he went down, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And so we're looking at Jesus as an example. Now, one of the reasons that Jesus is a good example is that he did not use his divine prerogatives to short-circuit any of this. He went through all of the suffering, and he didn't take any outs. He didn't take any shortcuts. He dealt with it just as we do. It is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And the Hebrew writer points to this. Paul points to it in Philippians 2. It's not that he didn't possess those divine prerogatives. He just did not take advantage of them. He suffered as we suffer, only more so. And so if we'll consider him and we'll think about him, then we will have the resources to not grow weary and lose heart. And this is, again, this gets back to a fundamental truth that when you're dealing with people outside of Christ, what they need to hear about is Jesus. When you're dealing with people inside the body of Christ who are getting discouraged and beat down, what they need to hear about is completely different. They need to hear about Jesus. Okay. It's the same. This is the solution, the answer. The beauty of this is the answer doesn't change. Whether we're talking to somebody who's not a Christian, we point them to Jesus and the cross. Or we're talking to somebody who is a Christian who needs help and encouragement, and we all do from time to time, we point them to Jesus and the cross. That's the answer. To every question worth asking, Jesus is the answer. Not who won the ball game. But every question of eternal import, Jesus is the answer. And so it's not, we don't have to kind of thrash around. Fix your eyes on Jesus. To our neighbor who doesn't know the Lord, fix your eyes on Jesus. To our brother who's struggling, fix your eyes on Jesus. And so that's the Hebrew writer drives that home and tells them not to grow weary and lose heart. And again, this is a significant threat. Don't underestimate how often people quit simply because they got tired. They got beat down. They got discouraged, sometimes very quietly, sometimes without others noticing them because they're kind of chugging along for a little while, and they get tired and they quit. And Paul is constantly, you think about Galatians and 2 Thessalonians 3, in both those places, he tells them not to grow weary of doing good. That's as significant a temptation as many other things we might think about. When we think about temptation, we sometimes think about moral issues, maybe the temptation to lie or gossip or sexual temptations or those kinds of things, substance abuse, those things immediately come to mind when we say temptation. People immediately go to those things. But there are many kinds of temptations, many kinds of struggles we face, and people getting beat down by the circumstances of life, growing tired and losing their focus is every bit as dangerous. And then they have recourse. Sometimes those other things are sort of secondary temptations that creep in after the primary temptation of just getting tired and giving up. And he's going to have a lot to say about not letting that happen. So the first thing he says is, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. And so the point number one is, you hadn't even gotten close to where going through what Jesus went through. Now, it may be that there's also a hint or a suggestion that that time may come for them. And it could come for us, too. I mean, I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet. They have not yet resisted. They have suffered a lot. I mean, the people have been in prison. People have lost their goods. They've gone through, almost certainly been kicked out of synagogues and those kinds of things. They have suffered in significant ways the contempt of the people around them. But it hasn't come to bloodshed yet. And of course, you know, if you want to think about it this way, how much of Jesus' blood had he shed? Well, all of it. You know, he, in the sense that he died. He'd gone the full distance. And so they hadn't even started. This is sort of like what God says to Jeremiah at one point when Jeremiah is talking about how bad it is, and God says, if you can't run with the footmen, what are you going to do when the horsemen get here? And so God basically says, if you can't handle this, what are you going to do when things really get bad? And that's kind of the idea here. They're thinking about backing off at this stage. What are you going to do when it gets serious? And so he says, you're going to have to up your game. Okay, now, generally, when someone is suffering, and they were suffering, and somebody comes along and says, suck it up, get back to work, you can do this, then the response is, you don't know how bad I'm hurting and you don't know how hard this is. And so the Hebrew writer begins to respond to that kind of thinking, I think, in verse 5 when he says, yeah, there's something you're forgetting here. Because there are a couple of responses to their suffering. They could be saying, just as I said, you don't know how hard this is. They also could be saying, I think God has forsaken me. I think this suffering is coming upon me because God is punishing me. God hates me. And the Hebrew writer says, well, hang on. You've forgotten something. You have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. And he quotes Proverbs 3, 11 and 12. And as is his practice, excuse me just a minute. This may die at any second, but I'm hoping I can at least get this in. Yeah, there we go. Okay, sorry about that. This is the Septuagint from which he's quoting. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he rebukes and scourges every son whom he receives. If you look at it, if you go back to Proverbs 3, 11 and 12, that last phrase will read a little bit different in the Masoretic text than it does in the Septuagint. But as is the Hebrew writer's practice, he always quotes from the Septuagint as he does here. And the point is that far from their suffering suggesting that God has forsaken them or God doesn't care about them, what does their suffering actually suggest? God is treating them like what? Sons. Exactly. He's treating them like his children. He's treating them as a father would his children. Do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you're reproved by him. And that's what they're in danger of doing. They're in danger of fainting at this reproof. Now, don't reproof sort of makes it sound like they may be being punished for something. I don't think that's the idea. I think the idea is that this suffering is the sort of discipline and training that a father uses to instill in a son the attitudes and habits that will lead to a wise and successful life. And so he's put them in a position where they have to make a choice between heaven and earth, between the favor of men and the favor of God. And he's put them in that position not because he wants them to fail, but in succeeding and going through this difficult situation, he knows that they will be better for it. Okay, the next slide was really, really impressive. Actually, it looked like all the others. But he's put them in this position so that they will become better than they are. And he says, if it is for discipline that you endure, God deals with you as with sons, for what son is there whom his father does not discipline? Now, what if there was no discipline? What would that say? Yeah, they're illegitimate children. They don't belong to God. And so there are probably two things. This is intended to be a source of comfort and encouragement to them, but it's also likewise probably an indictment of those who have done something to mitigate the suffering. Okay, those who have gone back to Judaism so that they wouldn't suffer. And Paul talks about that in Galatians. He says the whole reason the Judaizers came in and tried to get the Gentile converts to keep the laws because they didn't want to be persecuted. They wanted to take away the shame of the cross. And so they are skirting the discipline of the Lord. And he said, they're not legitimate children. Legitimate children are the ones that the Lord disciplines. They are the ones that are his. And so actually, far from this, and probably their enemies were saying, you know, you're suffering and going through all this because you're cursed of God. God hates you and you're not his legitimate children. And the Hebrews writer says, no, it's just the opposite. It's just the opposite. Now, Peter, when he deals with this issue, and he deals with it extensively in 1 Peter, he's very careful to say that, you know, if you're suffering for doing wrong, that's not the same thing. But if you're suffering because of your faithfulness to the Lord, then actually that is a confirmation of the legitimacy of your relationship. Suffering should not be interpreted as being indicative of some distance between you and God. That is not the case. He is treating you like his own children. And then he talks about earthly fathers. He said, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them. Okay, and so fathers, even fathers with the best of motives, don't always discipline properly. Even when they want a good outcome, they don't always they do it as seems best to them. Ideally they do their best, but their best is never going to be at God's level. Okay? He's always going to discipline perfectly. Earthly fathers never going to do that. They do their best under ideal circumstances, or they do what they think best. Everyone does that. And they're respected. Fathers who discipline their children are respected by their children for that discipline. But he disciplines us to what end in verse 10? To what end does God discipline His children? For our good? Yes, that we may share His holiness. And so God wants them to be set apart to Him and set apart from the world. And that's not really a leap for them to figure out that what they're undergoing is forwarding that. Because if they remain faithful, it is going to create closeness between them and God, and it's going to create distance between them and the world. They are this choice that lies before them is going to forward that status of set apart to God, demonstrably so. It will create more distance between them and the world, both in their thinking and in their relationship. It's going to create distance. It's also going to create closeness because they're going to have to trust in God and hang on to God. And so He is working in all of this so that they might share His holiness. Now, He goes on to point out that discipline is just always a lot of fun. Well, no, it's not. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful. Okay? So, let's go back just a moment. Jesus went through what He went through for the joy set before Him. That joy did not include the process of getting to the joy. Okay? Getting to the joy is not joyful. And He needs them to know that. He needs them to understand that. It's not going to be fun. You are not going to enjoy this. If you signed up for enjoyment, you weren't paying attention. You didn't. You not only did you not read the fine print, you didn't even read the boldface print. This is not going to be fun. Discipline is not fun. It's sorrowful. Yet, to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields what? Okay, the peaceful fruit of righteousness. The peaceful fruit of righteousness. The righteousness is perhaps not at all surprising. But why is it peaceful fruit? Okay, very good. There's a peace in the hope that you have. The fruit of righteousness is the knowledge that, or part of the fruit of righteousness is the knowledge that in pursuing righteousness, you have peace with God. Now, that's an important concept in the context of this situation, because are their circumstances peaceful? No. If they're being persecuted, their circumstances aren't peaceful. And they're not probably at peace with everybody around them. Persecution can cause problems inside and out, and He's actually going to address that here in just a moment. But when we think about peace, very often what we want is a peaceful set of circumstances. The mother of, you know, two or three small children may often utter the words, "I just want some peace." And what that entails is them actually all being asleep at the same time for more than 10 minutes. And so there'll be peaceful circumstances for at least for a few moments. And that's you know, perfectly understandable. Or perhaps if when we're at work and there's a lot of chaos and a lot of conflict, and we might say, "I just want some peace." And that what we want is we want everybody else to quit talking for a while, to stop the conflict for a while so that we can think or work or whatever. And so very often when we think about peace, we're thinking in terms of the circumstances or the actions of other people around us. And certainly not wrong to want that. But the problem with that kind of peace is That's not a peace that we can realize ourselves because we don't have any control over anybody else. We might have influence, but we don't have control. We might be able to influence people in the right direction, but we can't make them do right. And so we can't control circumstances. So he talks to them about another kind of peace. And that's the peace that comes from knowing that you've done the right thing. And whatever anybody else does, however anybody else acts, you've done the right thing. And you've chosen to do the right thing in a difficult circumstance. And that is going to pay a reward that transcends whatever's going on now. That's bigger and grander and more lasting than anything that's going on now. And so, he's trying to get them to look beyond, to see beyond their immediate set of circumstances. Any thoughts about 12, 1 through 11? No, I think that's good. Yeah, there's overlap for sure. So he now talks to them about, because obviously the suffering, the persecution affects a group of people unevenly. So some people are getting more of it than others. And we saw that earlier in the book where some people are being imprisoned and then in consequence others were visiting them in prison. Some people were losing their goods. And so, again, it's going to affect them unevenly. And so those who are getting the brunt of this are perhaps the most vulnerable. And he says, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble. And so the people that are getting beat up, they need help. They need somebody to come along beside them and help them shoulder that load and endure and get through this. There's a board game that a friend of mine actually made and marketed. The name of it, what was that thing, Jeremy? The where you have to break out of the prison. Pocket Dungeon Quest. That's what it's called. Pocket Dungeon Quest. And I can, if you're interested, I can tell you how to find that later on. But he had these things manufactured and sold them for a while, and that was kind of a sideline for him. And one of the aspects of the game is you're competing. The first guy to get out wins, but nobody gets out unless everybody stays alive. And so you have to help one another. If one of you is dead, nobody's escaping. It's game over. And we need to realize that in this situation, this conflict we're trying to get through, and we're surrounded by obstacles and enemies, that we need one another. And we need to take care of one another. We need to help one another. And if someone else falls, I lose something. I may not lose my salvation, but I am diminished by that loss. And so we need to strengthen and help one another. And the discipline for them may be the suffering they're going through. The discipline for me may be learning to help somebody who's going through suffering. And both of those things can accomplish God's desired ends. And so he says, when you see somebody's getting beat up by what they're going through, then you need to make sure you strengthen their hands and make straight paths for their feet. The idea is obviously, if you got bad knees and your legs are all beat up and injured, the smoother the path, the better off things are. Because every twist and turn and bump in the road is going to make things more difficult. And that's what he's basically telling them when he says make straight paths. He says smooth their path as much as possible. Make things as easy as you can for them while they're undergoing this. Take whatever load off of them that you possibly can so that they can get through and come through to the other end. So they have some time to heal. And so, internally, they need to help one another. Externally, they need to pursue peace with all men. Okay? And so, they need to try and make peace with their enemies. Not any peace. But this is qualified. He says, and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. And so you can't make peace by compromising your faith. You can't make peace by compromising the truth. You can't make peace by going over to the other side. You have to remain set apart, sanctified to God. But don't respond to evil with evil. Don't treat them like they're treating you. There's an opportunity here for you to act graciously in the face of persecution and hatred. There is an opportunity for you to respond with graciousness and joy and peace of mind to try to, as Paul would say, to overcome evil with good. Fight the battle, but don't let them choose the weapons for you. That's really the essence of this. Don't respond in kind. Because if you're not set apart from the world, if you begin to respond the way the world responds, you're not going to see the Lord. You've lost on a whole, perhaps a different level. Then he says to them, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God. And so he comes back internally again and says, no, you know, we take everybody home. There's no man left behind, is the idea. Now, again, you're not in absolute control of that, but in as much as it is possible, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled. And so what might cause bitterness in a situation like this? Where might something like that, how might that crop up? I didn't hear a thing. Disappointment. I think that's good because people have earthly aspirations, and if those aspirations are repeatedly disappointed, that can turn to bitterness. And he says, don't let that happen. You've got to keep your eyes on the prize. You've got to stay focused on the joy set before you. And if people become bitter over their lot in this life, it can destroy them. Don't let that happen. We'll pick up there next time. Thank you.